Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
So our summer business meeting is going to be July 25th through 27th at the Nugget Resort Casino in Reno, Nevada.
Tanner Beamer is Senior Director of Government Affairs for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, NCBA, on their upcoming meeting.
And that is where all of our policy committee meetings will take place. A lot of the checkoff business will be done at that time, and then the NCBA Executive Committee have their main meetings that will decide a lot of the business of this association. And if you have an interest in cattle markets issues or other policy issues, whether it be in natural resources and environment, cattle health and well-being, international trade, taxes, I would encourage anyone to come to that summer business meeting and participate in our policy-making process through some of those committees.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The last 12 months of data available for the PCE price deflator, that's personal consumption expenditure price deflator, that's one common measure of inflation. Another one is the CPI. The CPI tends to run higher than the PC price deflator, and so if you've seen the CPI index in the news, it's been running 8.5%. So there are various measures of inflation, but this is the one that the Federal Reserve Board talks about.
That's Dr. Michael Lengemeyer, an ag economist with the Center for Commercial Agriculture at Purdue, talking about where inflation might be headed.
The Federal Reserve Board is expecting inflation to decline relatively rapidly as we move into the end of 2022, as we get into 23, 24 in the longer run. I think they're rather optimistic. And so I think inflation could show some more legs than what they're showing here. And so we could see inflation in that 6 to 7% throughout most of 2022 into 2023. And so my main point here is there's a lot of uncertainty related to where inflation is heading. That's going to create uncertainty in the farm input price market all the way into 23.
As we look at higher inflation rates, it obviously makes us think back to the 80s.
I just remember from the early 80s how hard it was to reduce inflation. Obviously, we were dealing with higher inflation than we're talking about today. But nevertheless, it's difficult. And so this may, all I'm saying is it may take a little longer than what the Fed was forecasting to tame inflation. And so obviously a lot of uncertainty. I wanted to throw in a chart there, from a historical standpoint, what this increase in Fed rate means, 1.9% in 22, 2.8% in 23. Obviously, that's much different environment than what we've seen since the spring of 2020, right after COVID hit. They reduced that Fed funds rate to almost zero. Now we're moving into that environment where we're closer to 18, 19, but we're not going back to where we were in 2007, for example. We had the major crisis in the U.S. economy in 2008. We're not going back to that 5%. We're going back to that environment that we had in 2018, 2019.
Though there is a lot of uncertainty, Lengemeyer does point to net farm income as being a positive.
22 looks stronger than 21 now. And part of the reason why 21 doesn't look better than 22 is remember, I'm following a very simple marketing strategy for corn and soybeans here. Half of the corn and soybeans was sold in late 21. And obviously, we've had rather large increases in prices since the beginning of 22. And so if those that sold most of their crop, their 21 crop in 22, it would be even higher than that $349. And so that's part of the reason why 22 looks better. But it's just unbelievable to me. I say this every month, but it's unbelievable to me that 22 looks that good with our very large increases of break-even prices.
And not only does it look good relative to 21, go back in
historically,
history.
I think you'd have to go back to 73, 74.
Yeah.
To see something that good.
You're $100 above where you were in 2011.
Yeah.
But those are big numbers.
And
right?
that long-run average at $140, that's not a bad long-run average. We've had a good run in production agriculture since 2007. That's economic profit. I don't have economic profit illustrated on this chart, but those of you that loved Econ 101, remember economic profit is profit after we've accounted for all costs, cash and opportunity costs. We've had economic profit since 2007 on average. It's not huge, but it's been economic profit. That's a very unusual period.
Yeah.
And so I think that's worth restating.
Michael Lengemeyer joined by the director of the Center for Commercial Ag, Dr. Jim Mentert. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So ARA represents ag retailers, and it's the companies that work with farmers day in by day to help them grow crops.
That's Darren Kopic. He's the CEO of the Ag Retailers Association, or ARA.
So anything that a crop producer needs, whether it's fertilizer or pesticides or seed or agronomy consulting, pest scouting, precision application, custom application, anything at all to raise crops, that's what our members are there for. And our job is to represent those companies here in Washington.
And he admits that challenges continue to grow, or at least morph, for the industry.
It seems like each year brings a new challenge or some new twist. This year has brought several all in the same year. And so from the perspective of the retailers, they're trying to manage product availability. You know, if I place an order for a certain pesticide today, I don't know when I'm going to get it, if I'm going to get it, how much of it I'm going to get, or what I'm going to pay for it. And there are hundreds of products still on allocation, I'm told, which means that, you know, you're not guaranteed to get what you place. So that's a challenge. The fact that fertilizer prices are up so high means that retailers have to spend a heck of a lot more money to bring in that same quantity of fertilizer, and so do their customers. That makes for some interesting conversations with your banker about your credit line and about the trade credit that you might offer to growers. So there's all kinds of things that have happened this year, just a series of black swans and fertilizer supplies that have made for a really, really tough year, and then complicated by COVID, by transportation problems, by lack of labor. I mean, you just on and on and on. This is probably one of the more challenging years we've faced.
And he recently was preparing a presentation on top of mind concerns for ag retailers.
I started assembling individual buckets of these ideas and ended up dumping them all in one giant bucket because they all play off of each other to some extent. But, you know, in addition to the capital issue that I mentioned, transportation in general, even though the railroads are trying to improve, we're still in a situation where, at least in California, I talked to some members about this recently, the railroads are still 3 weeks late delivering freight. And so the Surface Transportation Board is actually interested in trying to get some reform done that will improve the situation. I think this is the best opportunity we've had in a while to do that. And so one of the suggestions that we made to them, along with many other ag groups, is that maybe demurrage should apply both ways. The railroads are fond of saying that it's an incentive to get shippers to unload and load cars on time. It could also work the other way and be an incentive for railroads to deliver and pick up on time. Of course, the railroads aren't very interested in that answer, but we hope that STB will be, and we can make some progress in that area. The other biggest ones, in addition to can I find enough people to run my operation, and is the regulatory climate going to be sufficient that I can operate and have products available? But, you know, I especially in the West, I hear about water availability, and people are talking about not just do I have enough, but is agriculture going to remain viable in some parts of the country if we don't get a weather change? And that's one that's it's hard to manage and hard to fix. We're kind of at the mercy of Mother Nature on that question.
That's Darren Kopic, President and CEO of the Ag Retailers Association. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So I think there's some evidence of consumers tightening their belt.
Kansas State livestock economist, Dr. Glenn Tonzer.
So demand is still up from a pre-pandemic perspective compared to a couple of years ago. You know, I don't want to mislead people there. But retail, so I think grocery store demand for the two beef as well as the two pork items we tracked in the series, was down in April compared to March. Food service was up a little bit, but that's a little bit misleading because it was down March. There's examples both in this effort as well as in other data sets that consumers are adjusting to higher prices. Again, not just in the meat category, but in inflation all the way around. Net pay hits are occurring for a lot of consumers. Mm-hmm. One thing we look at in this April series for the Meat Demand Monitor is about 70% indicate they've made some change in response to higher meat prices. So about 30% say they're not doing anything different, 70% say they are. And the most common adjustment is they're buying the same thing. So they're buying the same brand or, you know, non-branded cut, same package size and the like, but they're simply buying a lower volume. Other people are indicating they're buying fewer packages, a different cut, or they're adjusting the brand. Of course, there's other adjustments you can make. But what I want to drive home there is only about a third are saying they haven't made change, and over two-thirds are indicating they're starting to make changes. And that would line up with a lot of things outside the meat category. I think the meat complex is unfortunate that they've had strong meat demand throughout the pandemic. And as we've progressed through 2022, it's been pretty good. But I don't think the meat complex is going to be immune to discretionary income getting squeezed. I think that's what we're seeing.
Tonzer's been working with Dr. Jason Lusk at Purdue University on meat avoidance.
Jason and I and my colleague at Purdue that several of our listeners have heard me collaborate with in the past, we use both long-term historical data from USDA and more recent meat demand monitor data, which we just give summary on. That's beef and pork checkoff, you know, recent, I think the last couple of years, and more household-oriented, to summarize the status as well as the history of U.S. meat demand. Mm-hmm. And as you kind of teed it up, and I'll just give the title, is Meat Demand Outdoes Meat Avoidance, is the title of this paper that Jason and I wrote. And, you know, we're not cooking the books when we say this, but rather we're trying to provide some data-driven, you know, factual context that there's a long history and a recent experience where meat demand is very robust here in the U.S., yet there's a lot of chatter in the realm of what you might call meat avoidance, so concerns about, you know, impact on human health and the environment and so forth. And those discussions are going to continue. We're not even saying they should stop, but rather we're trying to give context on the average U.S. consumer is still a heavy protein consumer. Meat is a big part of their diet. There's a key role for taste, freshness, and safety in protein purchasing decisions that the Meat Demand Monitor allows us to outline and document. And it's consistent with how you can have strong meat demand even when there's ongoing interest in the general media about topics like health, environment, animal welfare. It's not to say those topics are going away, and I'm not saying they're wrong, but we try to provide some context on they're not driving protein purchasing decisions for the typical person. And that's how this adds up to our title, where meat demand outdoes meat avoidance.
But he still finds reason for optimism.
In this paper, Jason, I focused on domestic meat demand. You and I have talked only domestic here today, but there's growing global protein demand as well. And the U.S. beef and pork industries are well positioned for that. So I would say not only yes domestically, but also on the foreign market as well. So there's reasons for optimism. I'm well aware that we have higher input costs and the like that are, you know, creating challenges, but we can't lose sight of the fact that global protein demand overall, and certainly long term, we get past, I hope, some inflation pressures here. There's a lot of reasons for optimism.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
On Thursday, May 12th, the USDA released its first complete supply and demand estimates for the 2022-23 marketing year.
Dr. Joe Jansen is a University of Illinois ag economist.
In the report, probably the most surprising thing was that USDA has already lowered its yield expectations for the 2022 crop, coming in with an estimated corn yield of 177 bushels per acre. This is no change from the previous year, but below the trend line yield estimate of 181 bushels per acre, which USDA released at its Agricultural Outlook Forum back in February. This combined with lower planted acreage, as announced in March, gives us a lower production figure for corn in the United States for this coming marketing year. Corn production falling by about 655 million bushels below last year's crop size. A smaller crop combined with high prices led USDA to also revise lower its estimates for use. Feed and residual use fell the most, about 275 million bushels. Exports were also down 100 million bushels, and exports are a topic that we'll return to in just a moment. This lower production combined with lower use has led to a slight drawdown in ending stocks, but really a stock situation for corn that's relatively similar to what we see in last year, a very tight stocks to use situation below 10%, which is historically tight and leads to high prices like we've seen early for new crop corn.
Janssen zeroes in on corn and soybean export projections.
Another source of uncertainty is the demand side, and particularly export sales, which tends to be the most volatile usage category on the balance sheet. Right now, we see record levels of export sales commitments for the 2022-23 marketing year. While 2021-22 was a very strong year for U.S. exports, we're on pace to exceed that, particularly if we see large export sales over the next few weeks and months. USDA export sales data show about 200 million bushels of export sales commitments for the new crop marketing year. And that puts us well on track to reach the level projected in USDA's latest supply and demand estimates. On the soybean side, we see even stronger export sales pace to date. While export sales for the 21-22 marketing year are strong, particularly in the late months of the marketing year when we've seen greater export sales as the Brazilian soybean crop came in much lower than expected, and the world turned to U.S. exports to meet soybean needs. We see almost 500 million bushels in export sales for this new crop marketing year, which is a record sales pace. Higher early new crop export sales are typically seen in periods of high prices like we have at present. The question is whether these current record level export sales commitments for 2022-23 can turn into greater exports for the entire marketing year. Some of this buying is clearly precautionary as the world worries about the possibility of even higher prices. However, we're on pace to see strong U.S. export sales in the new crop marketing year.
That's Dr. Joe Janssen, University of Illinois Ag Economist. And this is Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
If you think back to February, the estimate that was put out in February, at that point, we have literally no idea what the weather is going to be. You have to assume normal weather. So you're really just forecasting based on long-term trend yields and routine productivity growth and that sort of thing.
Referring to the WASDE, the World Ag Supply Demand Estimates Report, that's the chief of the World Ag Outlook Board, Dr. Mark Jekinowski.
But now that we are, in the planting season and in the period when the crop is typically going in the ground, we can look at planting progress. We can look at the calendar, and we can take that into account in our modeling process and in really trying to predict what the impact on yields will be. This is still a very early forecast, but it is a forecast that's based on the fact that planting progress for corn this year has been slow, and the later that crop goes in, the larger the potential impact on yields will be. So we took that into account in our yield forecasts, as we always do. The process for the process that the World Board uses for forecasting crop yields is well documented. There was a research report that was published by ERS by Paul Westcott and Mike Jewison that lays out the process, that lays out how it takes into account weather and planting progress, and that basic method is what guides our yield estimates in May, and they will also guide them in June as well. So it's just reflecting the fact that we do have better information now, as of May WASDE, as of the minute that report went out, than we did back in February when we literally all we could assume was that the crop went in immediately as scheduled, and the yield and the weather was going to be perfectly average across the entire country.
So what adjustments could be coming?
Every month brings new information, and we update our outlook based on that. As I noted right at the beginning, I mean, this time of year, we're focused heavily on the South American supplies and this second crop corn harvest that will be starting up soon. What the outlook is for the yields and the production there based on, the weather data we have and the satellite observations, because clearly, especially this year, you know, the size of that crop is going to be critically important to, you know, potentially making up for some of those more limited supplies out of Ukraine, especially on corn. So that the market is watching that very closely, and we'll be watching that very closely. And, you know, and then in the U.S., of course, as you know, every month, every number is on the table. So even though, you know, I mean, acreage tends to, we tend to carry the March intentions acreage through till to July when we get the June acreage report. But again, every year, every number is on the table. If there were a real strong, compelling case to move off of that, you know, that would be considered. We're going to continue to look at those yield forecasts and potentially adjust those. And then, of course, every other part of the balance sheets. And we'll be looking at, you know, as we always do, export pace and biofuel demand and everything else. But clearly every month, brings new information that we incorporate into that month's estimate.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Relative to expectations, the on-feed number came out a bit higher than what had been expected by the trade going into the report. Placements number came in relatively more significantly higher than what the trade had expected going into the report, and the marketings were about a push. So that placements number being 3 percentage points higher than the pre-trade guesstimate and higher than the top end of the ranges that were coming out before the report really pointed towards bearish.
Bob Maurer is with Manduca Trading in Chicago.
Bearish demand is expected based on what's going on with inflation and squeezing of the pocketbooks. So in terms of maybe spending some of that, if there is any, discretionary income on some high-end steaks and stuff, that's a little bit of the psychology that's happening in the marketplace with the big slide that we've seen over the last few weeks. In addition, we've got weights that are still a little bit on the heavier side. So last week, the estimated average dressed cattle weight was 828 pounds. The five-year average is 805. So we're still sitting at relatively high levels, and that's just math, right? It's how many we process times the amount of weight, and that helps us give us the production number. So as long as that weight number stays high, slaughter number stays steady, then there's some extra product out there that we need to move along. So that's just one kind of thing that's weighing on the market a little bit. And the other thing is just a trend with the cow slaughter running fairly at a relatively higher than average pace, basically due to these big high input prices that we're seeing that have developed over the last year and a half or two, and then the drought in the western U.S. So more being processed, shall we say, through that way, at least more being coming out the fields and being processed, and that adds to the product again.
What about some of the technicals in the market? Maurer explains.
I know we don't always talk about technicals, but technically speaking, the formation that was put in today in the August live cattle futures is called a bullish engulfing candle, which means it opened up lower than Friday's low and it closed higher than Friday's high. So basically all of today's action started out lower, ended up higher than Friday. And just technically speaking, typically you would see some kind of follow through. So we'll see where it can get to. Short-term resistance up there, in my opinion, somewhere around the 133 quarter level. And we went out at 133.02 today, so that's not too much of a stretch. If we can get above there, then maybe we see a retest of that high from last week, which was 134.40. And if so, maybe we start hitting some buy stops and just they can propel a little bit higher. As for feeders, didn't necessarily have a bullish engulfing candle, but it did have a similar type pattern with opening lower and ending up towards the very high end of its range. It's going to keep its eyes on what's going on with the grain markets. And interestingly, today for corn, the market ended up higher. Wheat was up about 28 cents. So just looking at that in the aggregate there, that would normally be something that would be a bearish element for feeders, and yet today it was able to do that little bullish move. So I think that shows some relative strength there too.
That's Bob Maurer with Manduca Trading in Chicago. I'm Tony St. James. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The war in Ukraine is restricting the supply of wheat in some markets and creating very, very high prices in all markets. And one expert says there's no real short-term relief in sight. Joe Glommer with the International Food Policy Institute told a USDA webinar 60% of the wheat that's traded in the world now was already planted last fall.
So you really can't get winter wheat in the U.S. and the EU really to respond until the fall. So that means really next summer where those supplies would come in. Spring wheat in the U.S., the planting's intention showed very little increase, and you got planting delays because of the flooding and other sorts of things. So with wheat, I don't think it's until the summer of 2023 that we're going to see much response.
Or much moderation in high prices unless Ukrainian ports are suddenly reopened.
The probability of that right now, to me at least, seems pretty low.
This is Gary Crawford, Washington.